Governor Snyder says that he will be drinking Flint tap water, filtered Flint tap water, for the next 30 days to show everyone that it's safe. And he told reporters in Flint yesterday that he filled 3-gallon jugs with water and he's going to start drinking that. Well, he started drinking it last night and will do it for the next 30 days. Before the hour is over, we'll visit with MLive reporter Garrett Ellison, and we will spend a few minutes. Well, I want to find out what Garrett makes of the governor's claim to be drinking filtered Flint tap water for the next 30 days. But primarily, we're going to be talking about the replacement of lead service lines in Flint, where that stands, what's in its way, how much it costs, et cetera, et cetera. That is before the end of the hour. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us here today. 2 weeks from today, Lansing voters will decide on a millage proposal designed to overhaul the city school district. Officials are asking voters to add 0.75 mills to an existing school levy to raise $120 million for what's billed as the Lansing Pathway Promise. For Lansing homeowners, that figure works out to a $37.50 increase for every $50,000 in their home's taxable value per year. The project would fund an array of building improvements across the district. It would also create 3 so-called pathways designed to guide Lansing students towards specific career goals. Joining me now in the studio to explain the Pathways Promise is the district's head cheerleader and a supporter of the Pathways Promise, Yvonne Kamal-Kanul, the superintendent. Nice to see you again.
Good morning, Mark.
There are 2 major pieces to the Pathways Promise, infrastructure and curriculum alterations. Let's talk about the infrastructure piece first. Mm-hmm. I know the district, I think anyone paying attention knows the district has faced challenges in terms of buildings and facilities. What are those key challenges?
Well, our buildings are all eligible for AARP, apparently. They're all in the average age of about 55 years old. And so the way they were built 55 years ago is just not the way instruction is done in the 21st century. And so aside from the instructional component, there are also a lot of problems with our lighting and utilities efficiencies, windows, boilers, etc. But that's not really what the whole bond proposal is about. We do have some money that we've allocated for general repairs in order to increase efficiencies. But several years ago, before the previous bond proposal, a study was done, and there's about $300 million worth of work that could be done on the 30 facilities that we have in the school district. We've pared that down to about $19 million of absolutely critical needs in terms of efficiencies. But we wanted to build our bond proposal not around boilers and bricks and mortar and windows. We wanted to build it around an educational plan for our students. And that's really what the Pathway Promise is all about. Now, traditionally, you could do a bond proposal to replace a roof or a boiler or football turf. But we wanted to make this for the next 15 to 20 years. We wanted to create an educational plan that would put our kids in a pipeline for career and college readiness. And at the end of that graduation, you know, there's the Promise Scholarship for all of our students in the Lansing School District are eligible for a Promise or Hope Scholarship to go to either Michigan State University right here or Lansing Community College. And so we wanted to be able to develop a pipeline to that Promise Scholarship and to college and career readiness. And therefore, the Pathway Promise was conceived. And the bond proposal is all about creating facility improvements in order to support that bond proposal in those 3 pathways.
But you did. It sounds like you pared your infrastructure needs way, way down here. That $19 million, you view that as essential,
right,
to just maintaining the physical structures, infrastructure, et cetera?
Right. You know, we've been working on this for about 3.5 years. And so we have done a lot of work with, international corporations, Jones Lang LaSalle, with Plant Moran, to sort of study the capacity of the community. And while we think there's about $300 million worth of work that could be done in our district, we believe that our community doesn't have the capacity to be able to support that. And so we wanted to be prudent about what the capacity of the community was. And you mentioned that a $50,000 a year taxable home, which would be a $100,000 a year market value approximately, would have see an increase of about $3 a month for this additional levy beyond the sinking fund, which folks currently pay for.
No discussion of facilities is really complete without mentioning the sale of the old Eastern High School building on Pennsylvania to Sparrow Hospital back in January. You netted, or you will net, I guess, around $2.5 million from this, but you've got up to 5 years to decide where to send Eastern students. Do mm-hmm. I have that correct?
We have 5 years for our students to occupy that facility. With our bond proposal, we're very clear about where the new Eastern High School will be.
Pattengill Middle School.
Pattengill facility, that's right. There are 22 acres around Pattengill, plenty of room for expansion. The bond proposal calls for a brand new competitive gym, separate locker rooms, new office space. The clinic that's currently at Eastern will move over to that new site. We'll add another three-floor wing to that site, create practice fields in that area. So it's got plenty of space for us to expand, and it will no longer be known as Pattengill. It'll be known as Eastern High School.
and you support that move,
yes,
obviously.
Absolutely.
What's your best guess as to how long Eastern will continue to operate more or less as it's operating now? You've got 5 years,
yeah.
but what is the timeline in your view?
So actually, I went into instruction and not construction. So I think the construction folks, Chrisman Company has and C2AE have both designed a sequence where the first bit of construction upon bond approval will start on that Pattengill Fairview side of the city, so that we can transition our kids out of Eastern within that 5 year period of time.
Quite a few people process the Eastern High School sale largely in sentimental terms. Certainly to read social media, it's a powerful thing that you have been up against here for a number of years already. Sparrow apparently has agreed to develop a plan to preserve the historical nature of the structure. Now, that suggests, I guess, that demolition may not be an option. Are you confident the building won't come down?
Well, I know that I've been in conversations with Dennis Swan, who is one of the finest individuals I've ever worked with, and I believe that collaboratively with community input, Sparrow is more than willing to take a look at ways in which we can preserve the historic integrity of that building. That was part of the request for proposals for anyone who wanted to submit a proposal for the purchase of Eastern. They had to provide the district with guarantees that they would preserve the historic value of that building, as well as they had to agree to a partnership with the district in order to promote career and college readiness. So most people are, are focused on the facade of the building or on the historic value, but very few people understand that in this purchase agreement with Sparrow, they have agreed to provide internships, mentoring opportunities, partner teaching in the area of biotechnologies, which is part of that Eastern pathway. Very important aspect of what we want to do for our kids in the future.
Yvonne Kamal Kanul is the superintendent of the Lansing School District. We're talking about the 2 weeks from today millage vote for the Pathways Promise. We'll spend some more time on the curriculum piece here, I promise, here in just a minute. The combination, though, of the sentimentality and the sale of Eastern High School, how big a hurdle has that been?
Well, you could probably speak to three or four of my predecessors and ask the same question, but it has been a very large hurdle. I think, you know, timing is everything, and my philosophy is that people generally are not willing to let go of what they know unless they see a better alternative. And so I think the bond proposal and all of the work that we've done the last 3.5 years on creating a better alternative has really helped people understand how important it is for our kids to be moving into a 21st century learning environment. The Eastern alumni have been extremely supportive. They've given me lots of really good suggestions, and I couldn't thank them enough for their support on moving forward.
They ended up getting behind the sale.
Am yes,
I
they
not
did.
Career, a majority of them.
Yeah,
I imagine not every single member.
Everyone but one. It was they decided.
Every single member of the Alumni Association
yep, mm-hmm.
backed the sale
yep.
to Sparrow?
Well, with the exception of one person.
Wow. How many members is that?
I don't know. I just I really don't. There every year we graduate 200 or so Eastern students that we add to that alumni group. But the core alumni association group, the directors, the board totally supported it. And the kids. And so the day after the sale was announced, I called the principal and I said to Ms. Pohl, "So how are the kids reacting to this this news?" And she said, "They're so ready to go that, you know, they want to move forward." So this is really about them, right?
How will the outcome of the millage affect the Eastern sale, if at all?
Well, I don't know that we've tie-barred that sale of Eastern with the millage. We just know that, as I mentioned before, we have a lot of work that we need to do on our schools in terms of infrastructure. And the bond proposal also is paying for brand new furniture for every single classroom in the district. It's paying for technology upgrades. I want to say that, you know, we could do one-on-one computing in our district, but we don't have enough access points in order for our kids to be able to access the internet. So increasing our infrastructure capacity around technology, brand new furniture, which is flexible so that teachers can move towards 21st century instructional design, which is a cooperative learning and projects-based learning, as well as security upgrades. So while we have focused on creating learning environments with the Pathway Promise, we also have a number of other things we're doing in the district. So having a little bit of extra money in our savings account in order for, the rainy day types of things that happen will be very helpful.
Let's revisit the curriculum changes that are really at the heart of the Pathways piece, because it does create three distinct pathways. Each one leads to one of the city's three high schools. Generally, Yvonne, explain this for us.
So generally, there are a couple of points I want to make about this, and thanks, Mark, for focusing on the curriculum. One is that it doesn't matter where you live in the city of Lansing, you can choose your pathway. We will have open choice across the district. So where you live does not dictate the school that you are going to go to. So if you choose your Eastern pathway, which is biotechnologies, international baccalaureate, and Chinese language studies, then you can choose that pathway no matter where you live in the city. If you choose the Everett pathway, which is visual and performing arts and new technologies, you in the studio here must be able to see the incredible potential for combining new technologies with visual and performing arts for kids these days. And so we're very excited about that pathway. So no matter where you live in the city, you could be in the visual and performing arts new technology pathway. And then the Sexton pathway is the heart of Lansing, skilled trades, manufacturing, STEM, STEAM, and engineering. So the idea is that we would position our schools so that you could either do the traditional curriculum, which every pathway will have, the comprehensive curriculum that we currently have, plus a focus with business and industry, so that business and industry in the area would choose their pathway and provide internships and mentoring opportunities, summer jobs, co-teaching in each one of those pathways.
But could a kid from any middle school be on any particular path?
They could if they so choose to do that.
Okay.
Where you live does not dictate where you go to school.
Okay. But does the high school that you want to end up at, does that determine the middle school? I guess that's my question.
You can switch pathways after middle school let's say you're at visual and performing arts at Rich, which is the pathway to Everett. Let's say you get through with eighth grade and you decide you don't want to go to VPA, visual and performing arts. You might want to go to biotechnologies. You can switch over to biotechnologies. We're going to have open choice throughout the district.
What is the broader philosophy behind the pathways approach? Is this about getting young people to think about their future more aggressively at a younger age? That's what it looks like on the surface.
Well, you know, kids are making those decisions at a younger age than I think you or I might have made those decisions, Mark. But they're
I still haven't made my decision, candidly. But
I might retire before I finally make my decision. But they make those decisions pretty early on in their lives, and they know what their passions are and what they're interested in learning. So we want to provide them that opportunity. Really, more than anything, it is to marshal the resources that we have in our community. We have a wonderful community that has a lot of potential for our kids to interact with. And we just need to marshal those resources. And so as we look at our community, as we look at the jobs for tomorrow, not the jobs of yesterday, but the ones of tomorrow, we've fashioned our pathways to address those needs for the jobs of tomorrow. And so STEM, STEAM, engineering, manufacturing, skilled trades, all needed labor force in this community and beyond this community. Visual and performing arts and new technologies, labor force, and biotechnologies and international baccalaureate, three very viable pathways for the world of tomorrow.
Not your first millage proposal. You've been out in the community. You had a meeting last night.
Sycamore Park.
I did a Sycamore Park. That was it.
Yeah.
What's your feeling? What are you hearing from property owners? Are you confident? Are you worried? What?
I'm very, very hopeful. And the feedback that we've gotten at our focus group sessions and at our meetings with the community has been very, very encouraging. And I have great faith in the Lansing community that when they make a decision, they will make that decision to support our children.
One more formal presentation on the Pathways Promise. That is tomorrow afternoon, 4:30 at Geyer Park in Lansing. We want to thank our guest, Yvonne Kamal Kanul, superintendent of the Lansing School District, talking about the Pathways Promise.
Thanks,
good,
Mark.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you for being here. Coming up on Current State, Flint isn't the only city that could see massive lead service line replacement if state officials have their way. The big question is, who will foot the bill for a massive water infrastructure overhaul? We'll talk with Garrett Ellison, environmental reporter for MLive, to learn more. That's on the way. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Try to guess the animal that I'm talking about, okay? This animal's ancestors date back about 60 million years. Okay, it's a lousy clue. Second clue. The first published account of this animal dates back to 1520. One species of this animal can swim up to 22 miles per hour. They are birds. They cannot fly. Okay, time's up. Obviously, we're talking about penguins. The Polk Penguin Conservation Center opened at the Detroit Zoo yesterday, and at 33,000 square feet, it is the largest zoo display of penguins on the planet. Joining us to talk all about the center is Detroit Zoological Society CEO and Executive Director Ron Kagan. Ron, welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Your grand opening was yesterday. How'd it go over?
It was incredible. I was just up there before I got on the line with you again this morning, and the penguins are making all of us grin like little kids because they are having a blast. They're living in an environment that is 10 times the size of what they had before. The Detroit Zoo actually invented the whole concept of a penguinarium back in the 60s. And so we decided a few years ago it was time for us to create the next generation. And we did that by skipping just doing an improved facility and went for something that's just completely different. So this isn't just the biggest facility in the world, it's also the deepest, and that's important because penguins dive. And generally when you see penguins in zoos, including ours in the old days, it was 5 or 6 feet of water, but we created an environment that's almost 330,000 gallons and 25 feet deep, and so those Gentoo penguins that you referenced are going 22 miles an hour, they're porpoising, They're doing deep dives, and it is absolutely stunning.
You have that species at okay, 22
yeah.
miles per hour underwater. For those of you who are cannot make it down to the Polk Penguin Conservation Center soon, I would recommend the video that the Detroit Free Press filmed and put on their website. Here in recent days, it is really even you'll get a bigger grin if you're actually there. But it's really enjoyable to watch. Walk us through the visual experience of the Penguin Center, from what it looks on the outside to what
Sure.
you see when you get inside.
Sure. By the way, I was just trying to video about 10 Gentoo penguins going 22 miles an hour underwater, and you're only inches away from them, it's actually impossible to move the camera fast enough. When they go fast, it is really amazing. So what we want to do is give people a sense of what Antarctica is like. Now, not all penguins live in Antarctica, but a number of species do. So what we do, the exterior of the building looks like a tabular iceberg, and there are many extraordinary icebergs. Many doesn't do justice to this in Antarctica, but we've created a really gorgeous building that looks like a tabular iceberg that's cracking in half. And that, of course, is a hint that we also talk about climate change because it is indeed having a profound impact. And I can say that also from my personal experience of having gone there over the past 22, 23 years, five times, I've seen a difference in Antarctica. But the building is gorgeous. And then you enter, and the first gallery is a view through a huge acrylic window from floor to ceiling of the South American habitat of various species of penguins. And that's generally how people get to Antarctica. They go from the southern tip of South America, crossing the infamous Drake Passage, where waves can be 50 feet high and for several hundred miles. And we actually recreate that experience. So in order to get you 25 feet underwater, we take you from that gallery on a ramping system that is essentially like the deck of a ship. And the ship we've used is a recreation of Sir Ernest Shackleton's ship, the Endurance, which he sailed there 100 years ago. That ship, unfortunately, sank. Ours doesn't. But we take you through this 40
experience. You thought of everything, Ron.
Well, we've done a lot of research on this, and it is very Disney-esque. In fact, I suspect Disney will come and see what we've done because this is kind of beyond what you see really anywhere. But this is 360 degrees, a 40-foot environment that surrounds you with basically the ocean. And there's wind and spray and snow and rocking, and it's pretty incredible. And so we take you through stormy seas, we take you through calm seas, we take you through nighttime seas, which is also cool because you get to see the sky of the southern hemisphere, which, of course, here in Michigan, we don't get to see. So that's pretty cool.
Wow, thought of everything. And that's great.
Yeah, and then you get down below, and you are 25 feet underneath 327,000 gallons of very, very chilled water, and you go through acrylic tunnels, one of which also has an acrylic floor, so the penguins swim all around you, above you, to the side, below, and it's not windows. This is all continuous. In fact, people are scared to walk on the acrylic.
Yeah.
They think they're going to fall in.
Yeah.
And then you get to a huge gallery with a 40-foot-long wall of acrylic, 25 feet tall. Then to another acrylic tunnel and into a gallery that's all science-based, explaining climate change, explaining ice cores and sea ice and lots of other interesting bits and pieces, including the work that we are doing in Antarctica with a colleague who's been doing research there for 42 years. And then you come back up and go through iceberg calving, which is another very dramatic 4D special effect. And then finally to a gallery that's the Antarctic Gallery, where you see penguins as you see them in Antarctica with snow and ice and waves and wind. And it's really incredible for the birds and incredible for visitors.
It sounds like it. I'm speaking with Ron Kagan, CEO and Executive Director of the Detroit Zoological Society, about the Polk Penguin Conservation Center at the Detroit Zoo, which just opened yesterday. Tell us about the animals. How many penguins do you have altogether, and how many different species?
So we have four species. The biggest are the king penguins, and then we have the gentoos, which are the speediest. And then we have macaroni penguins, which are called macaroni because of their feathers. And in you mentioned some history at the opening. Some of the first folks that observed these critters were reminded of men in England in the old days that wore hats with feathers, and the macaronis look like that. So that we have macaronis, and then finally we have rockhopper penguins. So there are four species, a total of 83 penguins. They all get along fine. They don't breed with each other, but they do mingle and nest nearby each other, and they're just having a ball in there.
It looks like it. If you see the video, I'm sure it looks that way. If you're lucky enough to visit, we've got to make it down to the Detroit Zoo. It's been many, many years. We've been talking with Ron Kagan, CEO and Executive Director of the Detroit Zoological Society here, about the world's largest zoo display of penguins. It's the Polk Penguin Conservation Center, which opened at the Detroit Zoo yesterday. Ron, thank you and good luck.
Thanks very much.
And coming up on Current State, we'll continue the conversation with Lansing native Lisa Crone. She is the co-creator of last year's Tony-winning powerhouse musical Fun Home, which was just announced is coming to the Wharton Center next year. That and more after the break on Current State. Well, throughout our spring fundraising campaign here at WKAR, I'm happy to report that we have received more than 460 donations and raised more than $64,000. It's not too late to contribute to WKAR, to Current State, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Classical Music, and on at WKAR.org. Please click on the Give Now link. If you donate by 7 p.m. Thursday, you'll automatically be entered for a chance to win a night stay at Firekeepers Casino and Hotel in Battle Creek. That's a $250 value, courtesy of Firekeepers Casino and Hotel, proud supporter of quality public radio for Mid-Michigan. Use the Give Now link at WKAR.org, and we'll announce the winner of the Wharton Center Broadway Series package in just a few minutes. Flint is slowly making progress on replacing lead service lines, and the city's coating the pipes with anti-corrosives to prevent more lead from leaching into the water. While the Flint crisis is far from over, residents there are getting closer to having clean tap water again. But Flint isn't the only Michigan city with lead service lines tied into its water infrastructure, and state officials say that replacing lead pipes across the state could go a long way in preventing another public health catastrophe. Now, on Friday, Governor Rick Snyder endorsed a plan that would toughen lead test rules and require all lead service lines in the state to be replaced within the next 10 years. But exactly how that would happen and what it would cost are still unknown. Here with more is Garrett Ellison. Garrett's an environmental and Great Lakes reporter for MLive. Welcome to Current State, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this proposal to toughen the state standards for lead testing and replace service lines throughout the state. Who are these recommendations coming from?
These recommendations are coming from the Flint Water Interagency Coordinating Council, and through that, they're really kind of coming from the Virginia Tech team. The proposal endorsed by the governor on Friday is really reads very much out of the Virginia Tech University team playbook in a lot of ways, and it does reflect in many ways the recommendations of the recent Flint Water Task Force report that came out.
How would these toughened standards change the way Michigan currently deals with lead in water?
Well, they would drop the testing limit that where the federal government comes in and requires some sort of corrective action from 15 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion in the municipal water supply. So if, say, Grand Rapids, which is currently somewhere around 2 parts per billion, were to test at 15 parts per billion, according to the federal lead and copper rule, the water utility is then forced to do all sorts of public education, notification, and take lots of corrective actions to make sure that lead level falls back below the federal standard. Now, the World Health Organization has a stricter standard. They have 10 parts per billion. And the Virginia Tech team says any level of lead in water is concerning, but they use more of a 5 parts per billion kind of threshold. So the recommendation on Friday was for 10 parts per billion, so that's kind of splitting the difference in some ways. And, you know, it's been praised by some as, you know, much tougher and criticized by others as not going far enough.
In January, you wrote an article about the Michigan cities outside of Flint that were seeing lead levels at or above the EPA threshold of 15 parts per billion. Others, including Kalamazoo and Benton Harbor, were above the WHO standard of 10 parts per billion. These cities, unlike Flint, have had corrosion control in place. Why are the lead levels still high there?
Well, I think that is... That's based on the way that the lead and copper rule requires cities to do testing. And it's a complicated testing protocol that is unique in terms of their water contaminant testing. Other water contaminants are not really tested in this manner. Alkalinity, bacteria, turbidity, these all have sort of hard line benchmarks. Whereas the lead and copper rule allows 10% of a given water system population to test above a federal standard, or above the federal standard. So what cities do is they try to identify homes that have lead service lines or likely to have lead service lines, and then they have the homeowner test themselves the water in the morning after it's been stagnant overnight. And there's some criticism in of that protocol as being collecting very unreliable data. So what you have is cities with older homes that are using corrosion control, but they still have lead service lines. And so some of these homes may have water coming through municipal mains, which are fine, and then once the water gets to the lead service line in your street, it's going through the same kind of pipes in Flint, and it's coming into your home, and it may be going through lead fixtures in your home if it's an older home. And so some of these sites, once they test those sites, it's sort of a statistical distribution of the water system in a city. So it's not like a city like Kalamazoo, which tested at 13 parts per billion in its last test, is, you know, the people there are not gulping 13 parts per billion water, lead water, with every time they take a drink. It's just a sampling of the sites where they known lead service lines are.
Garrett Ellison is a reporter for MLive who covers environmental and Great Lakes stories. We're talking about a proposal to toughen lead testing standards and a move to replace all lead service lines in Michigan in the next 10 years. How tough will the new lead standards be to actually implement?
Well, right now what Michigan's proposing is considered to be the toughest lead rules, or would be the toughest lead rules in the nation. And as far as implementing them, the biggest hurdle is probably the cost of replacing lead service lines across the state. The Snyder administration has not said how this is going to be paid for. The legislature would have to approve anything, I believe. And, you know, there have been some estimates in just sort of back of the napkin type of estimations that of the 460,000 lead service lines, according to an American Water Association study, that are in Michigan, it could cost anywhere between $500 million and $2.3 billion across the state to replace them all. Now, the government, or Governor Snyder's proposal says, let's have that done in 10 years. So I think there's going to be a lot of people looking to how Lansing funded their program, because that Lansing has tackled this problem a decade ago,
right,
and they're almost done with it. Madison, Wisconsin did this in the 90s. So there are examples out there, but most of them have involved either bonding or rate hikes for customers.
One of the other recommendations in the list put out last week was to prohibit partial line replacement. Can you explain what that means and why that's important?
Yeah, partial line replacement is when happens when a water utility or a municipal utility work is happening on a street, and so they're working on the main or just doing some routine repair work. And while they do that, the municipalities will replace their portion of the lead line. So basically anything that's not on private property. That's known as partial lead line replacement. So municipalities have operated under the policy that whatever's on underneath your lawn is your responsibility.
Okay.
And essentially what Virginia Tech researchers have been saying is that doing that partial line replacement is almost worse than doing nothing at all, because the construction work disturbs the line so much that it releases built-up lead in the line
boy.
That would otherwise be just sort of dormant and kept at bay because of the use of phosphate corrosion control. So once you're cutting the line up, you're releasing all this lead into people's tap water, and these people may not even know that that's happening because there's no notification required of that routine municipal maintenance work on the street.
One of the problems that officials ran into while trying to find lead service lines in Flint was that the information as to where they are was not easily accessible. It was stored on hundreds of paper note cards. Is that the case or in other cities around Michigan as well?
Unfortunately, yes. Even the city is sort of, even a city like Grand Rapids, which is, seems to be sort of the poster child for economic rejuvenation, in Michigan right now, is using a paper-based system to keep track of lead service lines. You can go into a water department, and they got a file cabinet, and you pull it open, and that's where the records are. So part of the recommendation last week from the governor's office is that the inventories have to be upgraded significantly. And so it goes beyond that. There's all kinds of getting this into some kind of software, a database for easy analysis and whatnot through that. But that's it's not just Grand Rapids. It's lots of other communities have that.
We just got a few seconds, Garrett, but I have to ask you what you make of Governor Snyder's pledge yesterday to drink Flint tap water for the next 30 days.
Well, I think he's responding to much of the criticism obviously people think that he just doesn't care. What did he know? When did he know it? And one of the criticisms that's hit really hard is that he's not visiting Flint families. He's going to Flint. He's staging press conferences, he's taking action, he's going before Congress, but he's not talking to the people who were actually affected by that. So that's very much, I think, what was going on
okay.
Monday. If he's actually going to drink it, good for him.
We got to move on. Garrett Ellison is a reporter for MLive who covers the environmental and Great Lakes news. We've been talking about a proposal from Governor Snyder's administration that would toughen lead testing rules and require the replacement of all lead service lines in the state over the next decade. Garrett, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And this segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday. The Wharton Center announced its 2016-17 season last week, and among the Broadway tours coming to East Lansing is one co-written by one of our own. Fun Home, which won multiple Tonys last year, including Best Musical, was written by composer Janine Tesori and Mid-Michigan native Lisa Crone. When the musical stop in East Lansing was announced, Lisa came by the WKAR studios to chat with our fine arts reporter, Jamie Paisley. Last week, we aired part one of the interview, which dealt more with Lisa Krohn's personal background. You can hear part one online. And for the conclusion of the interview, we now dive more deeply into Fun Home, the musical. A brief warning, there is an acknowledgement about the existence of sex in this interview.
Fun Home is theater in the round, mm-hmm. which people, if they don't know, it's that the stage is in the center and the audience is essentially providing the walls of the house.
Yeah.
But for the 30-city tour that's coming, including right. to the Wharton Center at Lansing,
yeah.
it's proscenium-ized. Have you been involved in kind of making it into the traditional stage separation?
Right. Well, it started out as a presentational proscenium show. That's how we workshopped it. We did an early lab that was in that format, and then our run at the Public Theater was also in a proscenium. And so, our director, Sam Gold, who won a Tony for his direction of this, I mean, it's really amazing to watch him work, our designers also. And I think Sam's specialty is intimacy, is creating intimacy. And one of the great pleasures of working in theater and getting to work, as I have been so lucky to work with some of the most accomplished people working in the theater, is to watch mastery, you know, and Sam Gold is a master of that kind of staging, of figuring out how to put something in a configuration so that the audience feels intimately connected with it. So, he keeps calling this version that we're working on now, going back into the proscenium for the tour, the greatest hits version. You know, he's taking what he learned doing it in a smaller space, what he learned doing it on the big stage at the Newman, what he learned at Circle in the Square and the Round, and he's taking those greatest hits and making this version that's going to tour, and we're really excited about that.
You don't also in the musical shy away from sex as just an entity, because it's particularly for LGBT people, that can be a very daunting thing. It's
right.
like this culmination of this is not what most people do, but it's also something I'm very interested in. And you don't shy away from sex as just an entity into itself, as opposed to the romantic version, which a lot
right.
of people.
Well, sex is something I think most people do. And it's been very interesting to... I think a couple things about it. I think that's right. I mean, I think part of the story of Fun Home is the story of, you know, Allison's father, Bruce, who couldn't integrate his sexual self into the rest of his life. And then Allison, who did. And I think there's also a way that in representations of lesbians have been sort of desexualized. But it's very interesting to watch the audience watch that scene in particular, that dorm room scene, because surprisingly to me, in a way, you know, we're in this, you know, Broadway theater, and it's in the round, and so we have traditional Broadway audiences. You know, it's a mixed audience, but it's a, I think I would say, largely straight audience, many, you know, older couples, you know, the kind of people who go to Broadway. And because it's in the round, you can see everybody. And there's something about those first scenes that happen in the dorm room where the college-age Allison and Joan connect, where there are those sparks between them and that awkwardness of, I've never done this before, how do I do this? The way the audience connects to that in a direct way is so surprising. Because the form of the piece is slightly unusual, sometimes people connect to it at different points in the beginning, but I would say always that's the scene where everybody is in it and on board. And I think it's because those feelings of trying to figure out for the first time I mean, one of the things I wanted to put into those scenes was awkwardness and goofiness and not knowing something. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows what that feels like to just be know that that there's this you know, magnetic pull that you can't understand, and you're sort of moving around like a puppet and you don't know what to do. And you know, I just think, well, it's very gratifying to see how completely everyone identifies with that.
Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on calming down. So by the time you've woken up, I'll be cool, I'll be collected, and I'll have found some dignity. But who needs dignity? Cause this is so much better. I'm radiating happiness. Will you stay here with me for the rest of...
In addition, there's the voice that I think maybe Alison Bechdel didn't really incorporate a whole lot into, but you give that specific moment, almost an 11th hour number of Helen
and
her experience, because she's very much her own living character as well.
Right. Yeah, Helen, Allison's mother. Well, then Allison followed up Fun Home by writing a whole book about her mother called Are You My Mother? You know, I think for us it was very important that the play not do to that character what in a certain way Bruce had done, which was to sort of use her to create this version of traditional middle-class family life. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to find out what was, you know, what that was like for her. We wanted to make sure that we showed that this was a woman who made a choice, and she made a choice for a reason, even though that caused her pain, and to give her a moment to express the specificity of her grappling with her choices, to give her the same kind of specificity that we gave to her daughter and to her husband.
That's how it happens. Days and days and days, made of lunches and car rides and shirts and socks and grades and piano. And no one clocks the day you disappear. Days and days and days, that's how it happens.
When the Tonys happened, and obviously the accolades started coming in, the prizes coming in, there was one actually moment that didn't get televised, you know, the creative arts section when you won Best Book.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the different rooms of Broadway.
Right.
For many, many years, I have had a recurring dream, and I don't mean a metaphorical dream. I don't mean a Martin Luther King dream. I mean an actual while I'm sleeping dream, that I suddenly discover that the apartment I live in has a whole bunch of rooms that I didn't know were there. And I'm like, how did I not know about all these rooms? And I've been thinking about that dream as I've been thinking about this amazing Broadway season, because we all live in this big house. And we've all been sitting in the same one or two main rooms and thinking that this was the whole house. And this season, some lights got turned on in some other rooms. And we're all like, oh my God, this house is so much bigger than I thought. We're like, I didn't know that we had a garden. I didn't know we had a freaking ballroom. This pantry is full of food. I had no idea. The thing is, all those other rooms have always been there, and there have always been really interesting people in them doing ravishing things. And wouldn't it be so great if after this season, we didn't all just go back into the living room?
Well, first of all, I just want to say it wasn't the different rooms of Broadway. What I meant to say was the different rooms of theater in general. So I was what I really wanted to acknowledge was that theater takes place everywhere. It takes place here in, you know, Lansing and East Lansing. It takes place in Detroit. It takes place in off and off Broadway theaters. And so I wanted to, you know, bring all of that.
What's the next place to be explored? That is it transgender, since that's certainly something that's...
You know, I...
Because there's the film Tangerine. That's the transgender opening of doors that's happening right now as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's Transparent. There's just a musical at the Public called Southern Comfort that was based on the documentary Southern Comfort. I mean, there's a lot of trans stuff happening. You know, I think that theater is always about empathy and about the difficulty of empathy and the difficulty of seeing kinds of people you haven't seen before. I mean, I think one of the things that sometimes happens for people when they come see Fun Home, if they don't know a lot of LGBT people, particularly if they've never seen lesbians, you know, hold the center of a stage like that, is that when they leave, all of a sudden there's a whole new part of the world that's visible to them. That's what theater can do. I would have to say that's why, you know, having outsider voices in the theater is particularly dynamic in the theater, because it helps us to see that which we didn't see before. So who, what those next frontiers are, who we haven't seen, I would say that I don't actually know necessarily who they are. That's, I can't wait to see. I can't wait to see who's going to make theater that shows me something that I never saw before.
Maps show you what is simple and true. Try laying out a bird's eye view. Not what he told you, just what you see. What do you know that's not your dad's mythology? Dad was born on this farm. Here's our house.
Here's the Lisa Carone is the co-creator of the musical Fun Home, based on the graphic novel by Alison Bechdel. The musical won several 2015 Tonys, including Best Book, Best Score, Best Leading Actor, Best Director, and Best Musical of the Year. Fun Home was just announced as coming to East Lansing as part of the Wharton Center's 2016-17 season. You can find more about that season at whartoncenter.com, as well as more about the musical itself at funhomebroadway.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And speaking of Wharton Center, it's time for me to announce the winner of our Wharton Center Broadway Series package, part of our spring fundraising campaign. Congratulations to our winners, John and Cynthia Stone of Lansing. John and Cynthia, a member of our staff, will be in touch with you soon about your tickets, and congratulations. Tomorrow on Current State, more with Touré and Scott Pohl, Neighbors in Action, and lots more. We hope you can join us then. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.